true as gut epithelial cells create serotonin, facilitating digestion. Does the key to happiness then lie in the gut? You bet, but the reason why may surprise you. Gut-derived serotonin does not cross the blood-brain barrier, but at the same time, what happens in the gut can influence brain serotonin activity via its ability to modulate inflammation. In Chapter 7, we discussed gut health and the necessity for maintaining gut barrier integrity by consuming soluble fiber-containing vegetables that help seal up the gut's pores. Lipopolysaccharide, or LPS, a normal constituent of a healthy bowel, becomes a potent instigator of inflammation when seeped through a leaky gut. Aside from sending the immune system into an inflamed state of defense, LPS is directly toxic to both the serotonin and dopamine systems. In fact, LPS is often used in the lab setting, injected into mice to induce depressive behavior and neurodegeneration. Revisit Chapter 7 for ways to protect and enhance your gut wall integrity. Dopamine, the reward and reinforcement neurotransmitter. Like serotonin, dopamine is considered a feel-good neurotransmitter. It's most famously associated with motivation and reward, and it gets released when we do things like have sex, listen to our favorite music, eat, or watch our favorite sports team succeed. It also spikes when a new work opportunity or promotion presents itself, when we spot someone from across the bar that we find attractive, or when we get a notification of likes on social media posts. When goals are set and met, our dopamine system lights up, helping to motivate us to do things that evolution has deemed good for us and the species. But this system, like many others, can become dysfunctional in the modern world. Because of dopamine's role in motivation, it is heavily involved in aspects of executive function, where it mediates motor control, arousal, and reinforcement. Its presence is reduced in addicts, who attempt to normalize their levels with substances or actions. This is one of the reasons uppers are so addictive, as they commonly increase levels of dopamine in the brain via a variety of mechanisms. Cocaine, for example, inhibits dopamine reuptake, resulting in increased dopamine concentrations in the space between neurons. Methamphetamine, on the other hand, causes a flood of dopamine from the presynaptic neuron, while also preventing its reuptake. Crystal meth, one form of methamphetamine, is highly neurotoxic, killing off natural dopamine-producing cells, which compounds its highly addictive nature and keeps Walter White in business. In Parkinson's disease, the dopamine-producing cells of a specific part of the brain called the substantia nigra become damaged, so patients can take dopamine-boosting drugs that alleviate symptoms for a time. Eventually, these medications lose effectiveness in part because the artificial flood of neurotransmitters causes the downregulation or lessening of dopamine receptors throughout the brain. This is actually a self-regulating mechanism that all neurons have to reduce or increase the cell's sensitivity to neurotransmitters, but it is especially risky with dopamine. One peculiar side effect of dopamine-enhancing therapies in Parkinson's disease is a potential increase in risky behavior, including pathological gambling, compulsive sexual behavior, and excessive shopping. Dopaminergic activity is also reduced in ADHD, where there are fewer dopamine receptors in the postsynaptic cell. This means that more dopamine is required to sustain attention and focus. But is this a disorder? Or simply a brain that is hardwired for novelty seeking? Are you a worrier or warrior? Certain genes modulate neurotransmitter function and thus play a role in key aspects of personality. The COMT gene is one of the more well-studied genes of the bunch. It's responsible for producing catechol-O-methyltransferase, or COMT, an enzyme that breaks down dopamine in the prefrontal cortex, the part of the brain responsible for higher cognitive and executive function. Each of us inherits either two A's, two G's, or an A and a G. These letters represent variations called alleles. Having two A copies results in a 3- to 4-fold decrease in COMT enzyme activity compared to the G allele, and having a combination of the two splits the difference. Depending on what variation you have, dopamine either gets broken down more quickly or more slowly at the synapse. Therefore, if you have two A's, then you'll have more dopamine hanging around in the prefrontal cortex under everyday circumstances, because dopamine is broken down more slowly. While carrying 2 Gs results in the lowest amount of dopamine because dopamine is broken down more quickly. Those with AG fall somewhere in the middle. The A allele is thought to be the worrier allele, and people who carry 2 copies tend to be more neurotic and less extroverted. When worriers experience a spike in dopamine, they really feel it. This is why AAs tend to feel higher highs and get the sense that they are getting more out of life. Though high dopamine may seem like a good thing, too much postsynaptic stimulation can cause cognitive performance to suffer. Worriers perform poorly under stressful conditions for this reason, but display better cognitive performance under normal conditions. AAs also tend to experience lower lows and display less emotional resilience, being more prone to anxiety and depression. On the other hand, they're thought to be more creative. The G allele is thought to be the warrior allele, and people who carry 2 copies tend to be less neurotic and more extroverted. Warriors handle stressful situations much better than worriers, retaining peak cognitive prowess during times of stress and uncertainty. They also display greater emotional resilience and have better working memory. They can be more cooperative, helpful, and empathic. On the other hand, these noble warriors tend to feel as though they're getting less out of life. As you can see, both allele patterns embody personality characteristics necessary for the success of any tribe, and carriers of 1A and 1G, called heterozygosity, have personality traits somewhere in between warrior and worrier, embodying the best and worst of both worlds. To learn your status, sign up for a consumer gene testing service that provides access to raw data and search for SNP-RS-4680. Just remember, whether you're a warrior or a worrier, the terms are mere generalizations. Everyone is unique. Case in point, yours truly is a warrior with a creative streak. A recent New York Times op-ed suggested that the preference for novelty-seeking in the ADHD brain may be a trait that, until relatively recently, served a distinct evolutionary advantage for our species, having evolved over millions of years as nomadic hunter-gatherers. It makes perfect sense. A successful hunter-gatherer would need to be motivated to seek out new foraging opportunities and to be rewarded by her brain once she found them. In today's world of assembly line education and highly specialized career choices, those with ADHD may be silently suffering from the tranquility of repetition, to borrow a line from one of my favorite films, often ending up on drugs like Adderall and Ritalin. Footnote. That's V for Vendetta, a flawless movie in my opinion. Remember, remember. These drugs, like cocaine, are dopamine reuptake inhibitors. Clinical professor of psychiatry at Weill Cornell Medicine and the op-ed's author, Richard Friedman, wrote of one of his successful patients, he treated his ADHD simply by changing the conditions of his work environment from one that was highly routine to one that was varied and unpredictable. This may explain why a disproportionate number of those with ADHD and learning disabilities gravitate toward more entrepreneurial careers. Fighting hedonic adaptation, aka the human condition. A common problem with dopamine is that we can become tolerant to its effects when stimulated. This is clearly observed by the phenomenon of hedonic adaptation. Think of a former life goal that you've already achieved. Perhaps it was buying a car you'd always wanted, or getting that promotion, or moving into a new house. Certainly these are incredible and exciting life milestones, but as sure as you are human, your level of happiness regressed to baseline after the initial buzz wore off. This tolerance to dopamine, especially when achieved by any short-circuiting of the stimulus-reward pathways in the brain, can result in anhedonia, or a pathological inability to sense or experience pleasure toward things that we previously found enjoyable. But there is a solution. Absence makes the dopamine receptor grow fonder. Buddhist monks have known for centuries that abstention provides a means of stepping off the hedonic treadmill. Any prolonged reduction of dopamine release will cause an upregulation of receptors, thus increasing sensitivity to dopamine. While asceticism may not work for everyone, taking a deliberate time out from otherwise dopamine-reinforcing habits, technology usage, for example, can be an incredibly effective way of boosting motivation, reestablishing healthy relationships, and enhancing overall happiness. Not ready to totally unplug? Try this simple happiness hack for a week. Make a rule of no computers, emails, or texts for 1 hour after waking up and the same 1 hour before bedtime. As your system resets, you may be inclined to stick with it. Optimizing dopamine. Dopamine is made in the brain from the amino acid tyrosine, and as with other neurotransmitters, the building blocks are usually readily available unless a person is protein deficient. In this sense, a healthy dopaminergic system may be more a function of our choices and actions than any nutrient deficiency. Consuming foods that have been processed to become hyperpalatable, engaging in risky activities, and taking substances that hijack and short-circuit the brain's reward system can create unhealthy and self-destructive addictions. Sugar and rapidly digested carbohydrates like wheat are massive dopamine stimulators, evolved to increase fat storage at a time of seasonal sugar availability. The addictive qualities of sugar are so strong they are often compared to some of the illicit drugs I've mentioned earlier. Even the feedback loops created by social media, certainly a positive force in many regards, can cause the dopamine system to become dysregulated and promote addiction. Conversely, setting both short and long-term goals for yourself is a nice hack that allows anticipation, an important aspect of sustained happiness, and reward. Try picking up a novel exercise routine, learning to play a new instrument, getting out of your social comfort zone, falling in love, or beginning a side entrepreneurial project. These are all ways of healthily boosting dopamine. Norepinephrine, the focus neurotransmitter. Even though dopamine and serotonin are arguably the more well-known neurotransmitters, norepinephrine is equally noteworthy. Norepinephrine plays a very important role in focus and attention and is expressed in the brain whenever focus is needed, particularly in times of stress where it can enhance long-term memory formation. Can you remember where you were the moment you heard of the 9/11 attacks on the World Trade Center? I'll bet that day is burned into your memory in crystal clear, stunning detail. This is owed to none other than norepinephrine. The main hub of norepinephrine is a small region in the brain known as the locus coeruleus. Any stressful stimuli lead to an increase in norepinephrine, from a terrorist attack to a major fight with a significant other to simply not eating for 20-plus hours. Evolutionarily speaking, this is an important adaptive function. For much of our time on the planet, stressful stimuli required our immediate attention, and detailed, long-lasting memories needed to be formed to avoid such an event in the future, provided that we lived through that initial encounter. This is called long-term potentiation, and it plays an important role in fear conditioning. Because norepinephrine has such a powerful effect, undoing learned fear can be an intensive process. Ask anybody suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder or PTSD. Milder forms of stress can also activate many of the same pathways. The stress of learning a new instrument, solving a crossword puzzle, or experiencing novelty, exploring a new town or going on a walk with changing scenery, for example, all have been shown to increase norepinephrine in the brain. This can be very beneficial as norepinephrine helps to make the connections between neurons stronger. Doctor's note. Walk and talk for enhanced memory. When my patients and I get to know each other, I often conduct my visits while walking with my patients in New York City's Central Park. The movement and constantly changing scenery helps the patient remember my advice and helps me remember the encounter. Optimizing norepinephrine. Norepinephrine can sometimes work against us. Unlike in our distant past, stressful stimuli today don't always require our immediate focus and attention. And yet, the physiological mechanisms remain to guide our attention when a threat is perceived, real, or otherwise. The media often exploits this fact, something I know well having worked in TV. If it bleeds, it leads, is typically the mandate in television news, where the most stress-inducing stories are teased at the top of the hour. This approach activates networks in our brains that ensure that attention is paid to such news, as if our survival depends on it. Clearly, this is not often the case. In fact, avoiding daily news is one strategy to enhance your focus and cognition that will pay dividends, as chronic norepinephrine release can harm your cognitive function just as much as acute release can boost it. How can we mine norepinephrine for greater productivity? Exercise is one of the most effective ways of boosting norepinephrine, and the side effect of that may mean enhanced learning and memory. This was demonstrated recently when college-age adults who exercised on a stationary bike while learning a new language were able to retain and understand what they learned better than controls who were sedentary during lessons. For the millions diagnosed with ADHD, this strategy can serve as a natural cognitive enhancer, as norepinephrine and dopamine reuptake inhibitors are frequently prescribed to treat ADHD. While the vast majority of medical school curricula are absent any focus on exercise for their doctors-to-be, research has borne out that exercise may be the best form of medicine for the ADHD brain. In a slew of trials, kids who took part in a regular physical activity program showed enhanced cognitive performance and executive function and improved math and reading test scores, and demonstrated an overall reduction of ADHD symptoms. Perhaps we should keep this in mind when physical education appears on the chopping block at the next school budget meeting. Nerd alert! As Dr. Paul and I work on this chapter, we're taking turns writing and doing kettlebell swings. We both often use this hack in school when studying for a grueling exam. This not only would help break up the marathon of monotony by doing push-ups, squats, or dips between two chairs in the library, but would also serve as a way to increase blood flow, enhance mental acuity, and intimidate our peers. Interestingly, extreme temperatures are another type of physical stressor that can induce effects similar to exercise. One study found that when men stayed in a sauna that was heated to 80 degrees Celsius or 176 degrees Fahrenheit until subjective exhaustion, their levels of norepinephrine increased threefold. A study in women saw a similar but smaller boost. Cold water immersion is another massive neurological modulator and has been used by various cultures for centuries as a health-boosting tool. Anyone feeling mentally fatigued need only take a cold shower or have a dip in an ice bath to reap the mental benefits. The surge of norepinephrine from a cold shock, reported to increase over fivefold in humans, can make the brain feel like it's coming back online. It's perhaps not a coincidence that a major Russian holiday that involves plunging into freezing lakes through holes cut in the ice is called Epiphany. Aside from its well-documented role in focus, attention, and memory formation, some other very interesting aspects of norepinephrine have emerged from the literature. Increasing norepinephrine in animals boosted their resilience to stress, enhancing their capacity to rebound from traumatic events. Norepinephrine also has an anti-inflammatory effect in the brain, and stimulating the neurotransmitter may strengthen a brain region that tends to be implicated early in the development of Alzheimer's disease. A team of researchers out of the University of Southern California have called the locus coeruleus, the main hub of norepinephrine release, the ground zero of Alzheimer's disease. In Alzheimer's, up to 70% of norepinephrine-producing cells are lost, and the decline of norepinephrine tightly correlates with the progression and extent of cognitive impairment. The researchers demonstrated in rodents that causing norepinephrine to be released helped protect neurons from inflammation and excessive stimulation, both key players in Alzheimer's disease. Optimizing the system. Now that you know how to optimize each neurotransmitter, let's go over some practical steps you can take to ensure that your whole brain is functioning at its peak at any given time. Protect your synapses. The point where neurons meet is called a synapse. Each neuron may hold connections with up to 10,000 other neurons, passing signals to one another via as many as 1,000 trillion synaptic connections. This is modest in comparison to a child's brain. A 3-year-old may have 1 quadrillion synapses. Keeping these connection points healthy by minimizing excessive oxidation is key to the optimization of your many cognitive processes. In fact, synaptic dysfunction is an early marker of Alzheimer's disease, and the typical decline of certain aspects of cognitive performance with age may also be a result of synaptic dysfunction. Protect your synapses from oxidative stress by doing the following. Consume DHA fat from fatty fish or consider supplementing with high-quality fish oil. Avoid the consumption of polyunsaturated oils. revisit chapter 2, and increase consumption of extra virgin olive oil. Consume ample fat-soluble antioxidants like vitamin E, found in avocados, almonds, and grass-fed beef, carotenoids like lutein and zeaxanthin, found in kale, avocados, and pistachio nuts, and astaxanthin, found in krill oil. Express your inner wonder junkie. I love the term wonder junkie, which I discovered upon reading Carl Sagan's novel Contact. It's a term he uses to describe the central character, Ellie Arroway, who dedicates her life to exploring the unknown. New experiences stimulate synaptogenesis, or the creation of new synapses, while the loss of synaptic connections coincides with memory loss. Get out of your comfort zone and explore new and unfamiliar territories. Stagnation is death, particularly where your brain cells are concerned. Avoid toxic chemicals. One of the potential factors affecting neurotransmitter function is the consumption of toxic pesticide residues, which are nearly ubiquitous in the modern food supply. Pesticides work by causing swift and irreparable damage to the nervous systems of insects, particularly affecting the cholinergic system, important for learning and memory. Although it would take massive, concentrated exposure to have this effect in humans, it's not implausible that lifetime exposure to low levels through contaminated food could alter the function of our neurotransmitters, a scientific unknown at this point. There's also strong evidence linking pesticides and herbicides to Parkinson's disease, the most common neurodegenerative disease after Alzheimer's, where the dopamine-producing cells of the substantia nigra die. In human studies, people who've been exposed to large amounts of these chemicals display dramatically increased risk for Parkinson's, with exposure to some fungicides associated with twofold risk. Parkinson's disease etiology, what causes it to develop, is not yet understood, but toxic exposure is a leading suspect. Pesticides can also cause harm in developing fetuses via a similar lever. Studies in lab animals using model compounds suggest that many pesticides currently in use can cause adverse effects on brain development. Curiously, current safety requirements for pesticide use do not include testing for developmental neurotoxicity. To be clear, the verdict on how this all affects humans is not yet certain, and it could be years before science arrives at concrete conclusions. Given the astonishing degree of commerce tied to these issues, expecting firm answers anytime soon may be wishful thinking, as the research is sure to be mired in the eternal conflict between corporate interest and scientific inquiry. But by opting for organic produce, we may be able to at least stack the odds in our own favor as we await greater clarity. Engage in brief periods of fasting. New research from the Buck Institute for Research on Aging suggests that fasting is able to tune synaptic activity, giving these high-activity connection points a rest as an energy conservation measure. When researchers observed the neurons of fruit fly larvae in a fasted state, the amount of neurotransmitters released decreased dramatically, which essentially cleaned up the synaptic gaps. This is positive because excess neurotransmitters left to linger in the synaptic gaps can generate damage-causing free radicals. Fasting may therefore help limit unwanted oxidative damage in the brain, alongside its ability to reduce the brain's dependency on glucose. Chapter 10 revisits practical and safe fasting protocols. Avoid excessive stimulation. Multiple systems are involved in mediating sensory input. When our senses become overloaded, this can substantially diminish our executive function. This is perfectly illustrated by what happens when we watch a movie. The sights and sounds completely envelop us and we feel immersed in the universe of the film. This occurs because intense sensory motor processing inhibits parts of our brain responsible for self-awareness. During a movie, this is exactly what we want. Cinema is meant to be, after all, a dream shared by audience and director. But in day-to-day life, unintentional overload can occur at the expense of our executive function. The modern world can be excessively excitatory. Music, electronic billboards, the light from a smartphone screen, the flickering of a TV screen, or simply the sound of a train entering the station. These are all factors that, when combined, can overload our prefrontal cortexes and deplete our neurotransmitter stores. Here are some ways to reduce excessive stimulation. When requiring focus, such as when working or studying, ensure that any music you choose to listen to is instrumental only. Lyrics engage the brain's language center, which can compromise your ability to use language in other tasks simultaneously. Turn the volume down on your devices, TV, smartphone, etc. Keep the volume as low as possible while still being able to enjoy your content. Turn down the brightness on your screens. Many people keep their smartphone screen brightness up to the maximum setting. Set yours to adjust automatically to ambient light and keep it on minimum brightness at night. Use warmer colored bulbs in your home. Bulbs that give off a more orange glow contain less of the blue wavelengths of light, which can overstimulate the brain in evening hours. Eliminate overhead lighting, especially at night. Overhead lighting signals to our brain that the sun is out. Eye-level lighting in the evening hours, from lamps for example, is much more soothing to a brain that is trying to wind down. We had fires to light our evenings for 400,000 years, some estimate even longer, but overhead light bulbs for less than 200. Meditate. I recommend being properly trained in meditation. Whatever style you choose, research shows it to be a very smart investment. Take the time to do it right, and you'll have it with you for the rest of your life. I've written an entire beginner's guide to meditation, along with recommendations for good online courses on my website at maxl.ug/meditation. Next up in our journey to discover the optimal brain-building lifestyle, we're going to look at hormones, which, along with neurotransmitters, guide our moment-to-moment decisions. They're involved in everything from mood to metabolism, and understanding them will be the final piece in understanding the role of nutrition in attaining your ultimate cognitive birthright. Field notes. Yin and yang, glutamate and GABA. Acknowledge your biological excitation mode and inhibition mode, and understand that you need both regularly. Exercise and recovery, adventure and relaxation. Acetylcholine. Avoid toxic anticholinergic drugs. Ensure adequate dietary choline intake. Serotonin. Maintain adequate omega-3 intake. See Chapter 2 for a refresher. Get a blood test to ensure optimal vitamin D levels. Most often you will have to specifically request that your doctor test for this, and it is an inexpensive test. Though there is no consensus, the latest research suggests that having D levels in the range of 40 to 60 nanograms per milliliter is optimal. See Chapter 12 for further explanation. Exercise often, which sends tryptophan straight to the brain, in an effect that persists even after exercise. Without looking directly into the sun, ensure daily bright sunlight exposure. Even on a cloudy day, the light outside is brighter than anything you could achieve indoors and is sufficient to improve mood. Follow the gut health plan set forth in Chapter 7. Dopamine. Begin a novel exercise routine. Learn to play a new instrument. Get out of your social comfort zone. Begin a side entrepreneurial project. Start a new blog, newsletter, or meetup group. Break from the tranquility of repetition. Take alternate routes to work and travel more frequently. Norepinephrine. Halt chronic consumption of news, which causes, more often than not, an unnecessary spike in norepinephrine. When you require long periods of focus, engage in short, frequent bouts of physical activity. Genius food number 8, broccoli. Our moms were right. Broccoli and other cruciferous vegetables, including Brussels sprouts, cabbage, radishes, arugula, bok choy, and kale, are very beneficial to our health, in part because they are dietary sources of a compound called sulforaphane. This powerful chemical is created when two other compounds, held in separate compartments of these plant cells, unite as a result of chewing. Sulforaphane is currently being studied for its impact on a variety of conditions, and it has already shown tremendous promise in treating or preventing cancer, autism, autoimmunity, brain inflammation, gut inflammation, and obesity. One fascinating study showed that mice fed sulforaphane along with an obesity-promoting diet gained 15% less weight and had 20% less visceral fat compared to mice that weren't fed sulforaphane with their fat-inducing diets. Sulforaphane is not a vitamin or an essential nutrient. Instead, sulforaphane is a powerful genetic modulator known for its activation of an antioxidant pathway called NRF2. NRF2 is the body's master switch for creating powerful chemicals that mop up oxidative stress. While other beneficial compounds such as plant polyphenols also stimulate this pathway, sulforaphane is the most potent of the known NRF2 activators. That begs the question, what is the top known source of sulforaphane? Youth has its perks, especially if you're broccoli. Young broccoli sprouts yield anywhere between 20 to 100 times the sulforaphane-producing compounds of adult broccoli. If we're speaking strictly in terms of micronutrient content, adult broccoli is still more nutritious than broccoli sprouts. 1 pound of sprouts, therefore, equals 100 pounds of adult broccoli in terms of its sulforaphane-producing capacity. How to use. Add cruciferous vegetables to your diet and consume them raw and cooked. Just note that one of the two compounds that creates sulforaphane, an enzyme called myrosinase, is destroyed by high-heat cooking. Thus, cooked broccoli and other crucifers lose their ability to create sulforaphane upon chewing. However, you can add myrosinase after the fact. Mustard powder is particularly rich in this compound, and if you sprinkle some onto your veggies after they've been cooked, voila, the ability to create sulforaphane is regained. Pro tip. Growing your own broccoli sprouts is incredibly cost-effective and easy, even for those without a green thumb. Visit maxl.ug/broccolisprouts for my step-by-step guide on how to grow broccoli sprouts in just 3 days using the easiest method I've found. Blend them into smoothies, use to top grass-fed beef or turkey burgers, or add generously to salads. Part 3. Putting yourself in the driver's seat. Chapter 9. Sacred Sleep and the Hormonal Helpers. Do but consider what an excellent thing sleep is, that golden chain that ties health and our bodies together. Who complains of want, of wounds, of cares, of great men's oppressions, of captivity, whilst he sleepeth? Beggars in their beds take as much pleasure as kings. Can we therefore surfeit on this delicate ambrosia? Thomas Dekker, playwright. Want a biohack? Here's one. Go to sleep. I know. Easier said than done, Max. I run a business. I'm in grad school. I have 2.5 kids. I'm not caught up on Game of Thrones. I get it. We all have careers, obligations to our friends and families, creative endeavors, shows we want to watch, and of course the upkeep of our precious Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, Snapchat, Tinder accounts. But as you're about to see, sleep controls the tide on all the ships in your harbor, and a good night's sleep raises them all. It solidifies our memories, boosts our creativity, increases our willpower, and regulates our appetite. It resets our hormones, gives our neurons a cleansing bath, and ensures all systems go in the various regions of our infinitely complex brains. It's no wonder we intuitively know to sleep on it before making an important decision. A sleepless brain, on the other hand, is like marooning your ships on the beach at low tide. New research even pegs sleep loss as a toxin to your energy-creating mitochondria, putting it in the same category as processed oils and sugar. In one study published in the journal Sleep, a single night of sleep deprivation in healthy human volunteers led to a 20% increase in 2 markers of neuronal injury, suggesting that even one instance of acute sleep deprivation may cause injury to your precious brain cells. This is alarming news in light of the fact that half of adults between 25 and 55 say they sleep fewer than 7 hours on weeknights, and more than 50% of millennials have been kept awake at least one night over the past month due to stress, a recent finding by the American Psychological Association. A sleepless brain is primal, and not in a good way. Ever had the sensation of losing yourself in a great movie, book, or video game? What about a workout session, sex, or playing your favorite instrument? We owe this incredible, life-affirming sensation of complete immersion to a relative disengagement of the prefrontal cortex. Located at the very front of your brain, just behind your forehead, the prefrontal cortex is thought to be responsible for planning, decision-making, expression of one's personality, and self-awareness itself. Save for when we send it on vacation with the activities I just mentioned, a functional prefrontal cortex is very important to daily life. Unfortunately, this region of the brain and all its associated tasks suffers when we are sleep-deprived, according to research from the University of California, Berkeley. This can lead to a reduced ability to regulate our emotions. Why? The prefrontal cortex usually helps put emotional experiences into context so that we can respond appropriately, but it becomes dysfunctional with sleep loss, letting the primitive and fearful amygdala, the brain's fear center, call the shots instead. Matthew Walker, director of UC Berkeley's Sleep and Neuroimaging Laboratory, said in a release, "It's almost as though, without sleep, the brain had reverted back to more primitive patterns of activity, in that it was unable to put emotional experiences into context and produce controlled, appropriate responses. An amygdala set free of the watchful eye of the prefrontal cortex might be good for an immersive horror movie watching experience, but it's bad for daily life, especially when it comes to nutrition. Our brains are programmed to seek out sugar, lest they die come winter. With a sleep-deprived prefrontal cortex, say goodbye to your willpower and self-control. If you're prone to overeating or indulging in junk food, just one single night of sleep loss is enough to sidetrack your best efforts at a healthy diet." The glymphatic system, your brain's nightly cleaning crew. Anatomy textbooks are not updated too often these days. After the advent of the microscope, physiologists were quick to slice, dice, stain, map, and draw every square millimeter of the human body. And within a few short decades, there was seemingly nothing left to explore. So it was a major geek-out moment for biology lovers when Jeffrey Iliff and his team at the University of Rochester discovered what could rightly be called an uncharted organ, the glymphatic system. This system forcefully pushes cerebrospinal fluid through the brain while we sleep, providing a free power wash for our brains every single night. In the rest of the body, the lymphatic system is a physical structure that collects white blood cells and debris and slowly transfers them from the tissues to the bloodstream and lymph nodes. Those swollen lumps under your chin when you get a bad cold are activated lymph nodes. But unlike the lymphatic system, the glymphatic system doesn't have a full system of channels and nodes. Because the brain must squeeze into a hard cavity, there isn't room for a large physical network. Instead, the channels of the glymphatic system piggyback on the drainage system of the arteries that supply the brain. In an economical and elegant appropriation of the arterial system for its own uses, the glymphatic system takes over the brain during sleep, causing these ducts to swell up to 60% while the neurons themselves shrink to make way for the street cleaning fluid. And in a final coup, the system commandeers the artery's pulsations as a way to massage the fluid through the system. I've already mentioned amyloid, the mischievous protein that clumps together and forms plaques in Alzheimer's disease. We all generate this protein, and the glymphatic system helps to dispose of waste and prevent amyloid accumulation. The system is particularly active during the deep, slow-wave phase of sleep, but unfortunately, today's sleep patterns and our diets negatively affect this activity. Thus, poor sleep is associated with greater amounts of amyloid plaque in the brain. We theorize that by optimizing our sleep, we may help these proteins get cleared away before they ever cause problems. How might we optimize glymphatic clearance? It's still a recently discovered system, and we certainly don't have all the answers yet. However, as discussed in Chapter 6, fasting before bed to reduce circulating insulin may be one way to encourage the brain and body's custodial duties. Omega-3 fatty acids, abundant in the fat of wild fish and grass-fed beef, were also shown to promote optimal functioning of the glymphatic system. By following the Genius Plan, you'll be getting optimal amounts of omega-3 fatty acids. At the end of the day, however, the best way to attain a spotless brain is just to get good sleep, consistently. There are myriad factors that affect our sleep quality. Work stress, family duties, and TV binges that take us into the wee hours. Who isn't guilty of the occasional Netflix marathon? I certainly am. But diet may play a significant role here as well. Two studies, one published in The Lancet and the other in Nutritional Neuroscience, both showed that after just 2 days of a high-carbohydrate, low-fat diet, healthy, normal-weight male subjects spent less time in slow-wave sleep compared to those on a low-carbohydrate, high-fat diet. Observational research in both men and women has confirmed that higher consumption of sugar and carbohydrates is associated with less time spent in slow-wave sleep. Certain nutrients, on the other hand, may increase sleep quality. Higher fiber consumption seems to promote deeper, more cleansing sleep. If keeping your brain plaque-free wasn't a compelling enough reason for you to reconsider your sleep habits, let me break some more news to you. Quality sleep is a precondition for having the willpower to change your other habits, causing hormonal changes that will supercharge your results. Sleep is a keystone for the implementation of all the other changes you're going to make in the Genius Plan. Sleep Optimization Cheat Sheet. Keep your bedroom cool. The body likes cooler temperatures to sleep. Take a warm shower or bath before bed. The drop in body temperature once you step out should signal to your body that it's time to sleep. Use your bed for sleeping, and sex, duh, only. As soon as you wake up, get out of bed and don't return to it until you want to go to sleep for the night. Avoid alcohol. Even though alcohol helps you get to sleep faster, it lessens the amount of time spent in REM sleep, which is your deepest phase of sleep. Avoid nighttime blue light exposure. Try blue light blocking glasses. See the PDF for recommendations. Avoid screen exposure and make sure the bulbs in your house are all warm in color temperature. Keep your smartphone far away from your bed, anywhere but arm's reach. Keep your room dark. Even a little bit of light can disrupt sleep. People who slept under a very dim light, 10 lux, for just one night had decreased working memory and brain function. Set a caffeine curfew. Limit caffeine consumption to 4 p.m. at the latest, maybe even earlier if you are a genetically slow metabolizer. A gene testing service like 23andMe can let you know. Eat more fiber and omega-3 fats and fewer carbs. Inflammation affects sleep quality, and byproducts of fiber consumption, like butyrate, may promote deeper, more rejuvenating sleep. Stop eating at least an hour before bed. Nocturnal eating can sabotage sleep. Get direct sunlight within 20 minutes of waking, especially during daylight savings time or when traveling. Bright light helps anchor your body's circadian rhythm, which regulates the natural ebb and flow of your sleep-wake cycles. Use an app as an alarm clock. Apps like Sleep Cycle wake you only when your sleep has entered one of its lighter phases, preventing that awful feeling of being woken up in the middle of deep REM sleep, your deepest sleep phase. Hormonal helpers. Our behaviors are often motivated by our brains, but sometimes they originate in the body. In many ways, willpower is like a marionette puppet with chemical messengers called hormones at the strings. Unlike neurotransmitters, which allow individual neurons to communicate with their next-door neighbors, hormones are long-range messengers, being released in one part of the body and having impact in another. For example, a hormone called leptin may come from the fat cells around your belly, directed toward a region in the brain that controls energy expenditure. Or cortisol, secreted by your adrenal glands just above your kidneys, may impact parts of your brain involved in memory. By understanding the relationships sleep loss and stress have with these master hormone controllers, we may achieve the strongest domain over our willpower, which is to say, we'll rarely have to use it. Insulin, the storage hormone. In Chapter 4, I described how excessive insulin might turn our brains into amyloid plaque landfills. But excessive carbohydrate intake is not the only villain in the fight for a plaque-free brain. Sleep is also critical for regulating our hormones, including insulin. Research suggests that even as little as one night of partial sleep deprivation can temporarily increase insulin resistance in an otherwise healthy person. Short-term sleep restriction has even been shown to increase risk for type 2 diabetes. But there is good news. Some of the negative effects of sleep debt appear to be reversed by a weekend of catch-up sleep, around 9.7 hours per night. On the other hand, playing a cat-and-mouse game with sleep is not only a bad habit to get into, but a poor strategy for long-term health. Doctor's note: sleep loss can make you, or keep you, fat. It is impossible to overstate the importance of sleep. In my clinical practice, if a patient comes to me with a goal of weight loss or body recomposition and is sleeping fewer than 7 full hours a night, I will say, in not so many words, that she is wasting her money if she's not also committed to improving sleep duration and quality. Recent studies, since replicated, have confirmed that sleep deprivation, which means fewer than 6 hours of sleep for a single night, leads to an unintentional ingestion of an extra 400 to 500 calories the following day, and those additional calories almost always come from carbs. Multiply this by a few nights, and you've got yourself a spare tire in a matter of weeks. Already overweight? Same rules apply. You are seriously hurting your chances of dropping extra weight when sleep-deprived. Ghrelin, the hunger hormone. Another hormone affected by sleep is ghrelin. Secreted by your stomach, ghrelin tells your brain when it's time to be hungry. Your ghrelin level increases just before meals or when the stomach is empty, and decreases after meals or when the stomach is stretched. This hormone can also impact your behavior. When mice and humans are injected with ghrelin, the number of meals consumed increases. Ghrelin surges with just a single night of sleep debt. This may be why one night of sleep deprivation will provoke, on average, an excess intake of 400 to 500 calories that day, mostly from carbohydrates, coinciding with increased inflammation, high blood pressure, and cognitive problems. Aside from getting more sleep, how can we make ghrelin work for us? Eating fewer but larger meals throughout the day trains your body to produce less of the hormone. Science has now revealed that the advice to eat small, frequent meals to stoke the metabolic flame is bunk. Metabolic chamber studies, when volunteers live in a room outfitted with instruments that measure how their bodies use air, food, and water under different conditions, show that whether you eat 2 meals a day or 6, your metabolic rate is exactly the same. This is liberating because the approach of eating fewer and larger meals provides lifestyle flexibility, allows us to feel full, reduces decision fatigue, and helps keep the amount of time insulin is circulating to a minimum. Be aware, though, that as you adjust to fewer and larger meals, it may take at least a few days for your stomach to stop sending out signals saying it's time to eat. Leptin, the metabolic throttle hormone. Sleep can also negatively affect another hormone involved in hunger called leptin. Leptin is the satiety hormone that helps regulate energy balance by inhibiting hunger, and it plummets with sleep deprivation. Leptin's job is to control energy expenditure through its action on the hypothalamus, the brain's master metabolic regulator. Because leptin is secreted by fat cells, the more fat cells one has, the more circulating leptin. The brain interprets higher levels of leptin as permission to open up the throttle a bit on the rate at which our bodies burn calories. After all, food is seemingly plentiful. But as with insulin, chronically elevated leptin can cause leptin resistance to develop, and the signal of satiety and the positive benefits of leptin on metabolism becomes lost. This is the unfortunate paradox faced by those who lose weight and try to keep it off. They're fighting against the 1-2 punch of both lower leptin levels and leptin resistance. Low leptin increases hunger while decreasing thyroid activity, sympathetic tone, and energy expenditure in skeletal muscle, adding up to a major metabolic slowdown. Anyone who's undergone massive weight loss understands this system gone awry. A 250-pound person who diets down to 200 pounds usually burns about 300 to 400 fewer calories per day than someone who was 200 pounds to start. On the other hand, recent studies performed by Harvard obesity researcher David Ludwig suggest that very low-carb diets can offset some of this metabolic disadvantage to the tune of 100 to 300 calories per day, the equivalent of a daily 3-mile run. The great news is that following the protocol outlined in this book will enable you to achieve this metabolic extra credit. When we engage in bouts of fasting or very low-carb diets, our leptin levels are reduced. But this has the benefit of increasing the amount of leptin receptors in the hypothalamus. Thus, by fasting, we can regain leptin sensitivity, and by incorporating periodic high-carb, low-fat refeeds, we can keep our metabolism revving like a 60s muscle car. Hacking leptin to look better naked. Once you are fat-adapted, periodic high-carb meals can be a potent way of promoting healthy leptin dynamics. This is because carbohydrate consumption and the insulin secreted as a result are powerful leptin boosters. The corresponding leptin surge messages the hypothalamus to ramp up the body's metabolic engines. This system becomes dysfunctional if there is chronic high carbohydrate consumption, which can promote leptin resistance. But when combined with exercise, a weekly higher carb refeed can increase energy expenditure, recalibrate mood, and accelerate fat loss, especially for those who've seen their weight loss stall. A refeed of 100 to 150 grams of carbs should do the trick. This is still dramatically less than that of a person consuming the standard American diet. Estimates are that the average Westerner consumes upward of 300 grams of carbohydrates per day. This is also not an excuse to eat junk food. These higher carb meals should be low in fat, which, if you recall from Chapter 2, can potentiate the insulin surge and create a temporary setting of insulin resistance. Fat can also prevent leptin from crossing the blood-brain barrier. Great carbs for a refeed include rice, sushi is an excellent refeed food, starchy vegetables like potatoes, or your favorite higher sugar fruit. Leptin also plays an important role in cognitive function, which is why keeping it within the normal range, i.e. by not lowering it with prolonged low-calorie dieting or poor sleep and by topping it off with periodic refeeds, is critical. While leptin's most famous role involves its communication with the hypothalamus, receptors for leptin have also been identified in areas of the brain responsible for emotion. And there is a strong relationship between low levels of leptin and depression and anxiety. From an evolutionary standpoint, this makes quite a bit of sense. Leptin works with insulin to paint a picture for your brain of the state of food availability, and when food is scarce, this likely tells the brain to alter behavior in a way that conserves energy. This can manifest as social withdrawal, an inability to feel pleasure, or a lack of motivation. It should come as no surprise that leptin resistance can contribute to depression. In a recent study, overweight and obese women had significantly increased symptoms of depression and anxiety despite having higher leptin levels than lean controls. For these leptin-resistant women, leptin is present, but the brain cannot sense it. In terms of overall brain health, leptin is involved in synaptic plasticity in the hippocampus, where it facilitates long-term potentiation, the creation of strong, long-lasting memories. It's been shown to improve memory in rodent models of aging and Alzheimer's disease, and may enhance the clearance of amyloid beta, the protein that accumulates to toxic levels with age. The more you can maintain your sensitivity to leptin, the healthier and happier you will be. Growth hormone, the repair and preserve hormone. In adults, growth hormone, or GH, is known primarily for its role as a repair hormone. Athletes have been known to use GH for its performance-enhancing qualities, namely its ability to accelerate repair of connective tissue. But GH, which is secreted by the brain's pituitary gland, is also a powerful cognitive modulator, shown to improve many aspects of brain function, including processing speed and mood. In older adults, GH replacement therapy has been shown to boost cognitive function in patients with mild cognitive impairment, pre-dementia that often leads to Alzheimer's disease, and in healthy controls after just 5 months. But while injecting extra growth hormone is both illegal and potentially dangerous, there are a few hacks at our disposal to naturally boost this powerful chemical. While growth hormone deficiency manifests as severely stunted growth and stature in children, which led to its initial identification and naming, it has a very different primary role in adults to preserve lean mass during periods of famine or in a fasted state. One of the best ways to boost growth hormone, therefore, is through intermittent fasting. When one fasts for anywhere from 14 to 16 hours onward for a female and 16 to 18 hours onward for a male, growth hormone begins to increase. After 24 hours of fasting, growth hormone has been reported to shoot up as high as 2,000%. Aside from fasting, heat conditioning, sauna use, for example, is a powerful way of boosting growth hormone. In one study, two 20-minute sauna sessions at 80 degrees Celsius or 176 degrees Fahrenheit, separated by a 30-minute cooling period, caused growth hormone levels to surge twofold over baseline, while two 15-minute sauna sessions at 100 degrees Celsius or 212 degrees Fahrenheit, separated by a 30-minute cooling period, resulted in a fivefold increase in growth hormone. While sauna-induced growth hormone may stay elevated for a couple of hours afterward, one study found that 2 1-hour sauna sessions a day at 80 degrees Celsius or 176 degrees Fahrenheit for 7 days increased growth hormone by 16-fold by the third day, showing a clear benefit from repeated exposure. As easy as it is to boost growth hormone, it's even easier to deplete it, especially today. Chronic stress is one of the major modern growth hormone fighters, directly at odds with maintaining our precious lean muscle tissue. Carbohydrate consumption immediately turns off growth hormone production, providing an explanation as to why low-calorie diets without carbohydrate restriction can lead to muscle loss concurrent with fat loss. Finally, getting fewer than 7 hours of sleep has been shown to negatively affect growth hormone production. In fact, most of the growth hormone in our bodies is produced during slow-wave sleep, so getting 2 to 3 full cycles is critical. Shoot for 8 hours a night. Cortisol, the carpe diem hormone. Cortisol, a master circadian regulator, peaks upon waking, creating a temporary catabolic state in the body. Often thought of solely as a stress hormone, cortisol is also instrumental as the waking hormone, liberating energy as carbs, fat, and amino acids for use in the early daytime hours. When insulin and cortisol are both present at the same time, i.e. after a carbohydrate-rich breakfast, cortisol's fat-burning effect will be shut down, and it will only exert its catabolic effect on your muscles. Clearly, not a desirable scenario. While skipping an early breakfast may help cortisol fulfill its job, should you choose to eat a morning meal, it should consist solely of fat and protein and fibrous veggies, not carbohydrates. This is contrary to the popular dogma of starting a day with a hearty bowl of oatmeal or cereal, to say nothing of the bagels, muffins, pancakes, pastries, and more that are so commonly consumed in the morning. Cortisol's dark side. National Geographic journalist Dan Buettner has discovered and studied the 5 places in the world, dubbed Blue Zones, where people live the longest. The lifestyles of people in these zones provide examples that we can use to form hypotheses about what promotes healthy aging. For example, many of these communities build non-negotiable intermissions from work into their days, and I'm not just talking about a lunch break. The world's longest-lived people have routines that shed stress, Buettner writes in The Blue Zones. He continues, "The Okinawans call it ikigai, and the Nicoyans of Costa Rica call it plan de vida. For both, it translates to why I wake up in the morning. In all Blue Zones, people had something to live for beyond just work. Research has shown that knowing your sense of purpose is worth up to 7 years of extra life expectancy. Unless we develop effective ways of diffusing stress, which, let's face it, is an unavoidable aspect of 21st century living, cortisol can become elevated for long periods, resulting in some serious physiological consequences. But before we get to that, let's define what chronic stress is and isn't. Chronic stress is not what you feel when giving an occasional presentation, suffering through a move, or the chance traffic jam when you're already late. The forms that chronic stress usually take are the following, and make a mental note if any of these seem familiar. Showing up every day at a job that you hate. Prolonged financial hardship. Having to work under a boss that you dislike. Being stuck in a long-term relationship gone sour. Having a bully at school. Military duty. Chronic noise exposure. A stressful daily commute to and from work. Medical school. Dr. Paul. Unpleasant, protracted, and a recent invention in evolutionary terms, this type of chronic stress activates the amygdala, that primitive survival region associated with fear. Its job is to kick off a cascade of biochemical processes that were initially meant to help scuttle us from harm's way when we were confronted by a physical threat, say, a lion charging toward us on the savannah. Imagine this scenario. You are a hunter-gatherer going about your day, peacefully foraging for berries under the hot East African sun. Suddenly, a lion appears in your periphery. Let's pretend for the sake of this story that lion's name is Mufasa. Mufasa hasn't eaten in days, nor has his hungry cub back at the pride. Let's call him Simba. Mufasa sees